Number one, what's the difference between focus and concentrate? Concentrate is what you do with force. Focus is what you let the mind settle on. So one is with force, one is just a little bit of wisdom. You just let it settle in the center. You give it importance. When you give it importance, you do the marketing campaign. You know, that things like the breath is important, sounds aren't, nimittas are important. You know, the breath isn't when you get to that stage. When you do the marketing campaign, the mind focuses by itself. You don't do it. If you do it, that's called concentration. And then you will get headache. You will get tired. It won't work. Are we allowed to light incense? No. Number one, it really stinks the room out and it leaves a smell there. In here that some people are allergic to incense. And if you light it outside, you start a bushfire. You don't need incense. The Buddha said that if you keep precepts, then you are fragrant. So that's all the fragrance you need. So why do you want to light incense for? Sometimes that in Asian countries, yes, you can light incense to keep the mosquitoes away, but there's no mosquitoes here. Even the mosquitoes don't like the hot weather, so they've all gone somewhere else. So no need to light incense. If we are non-self, so we don't need to take responsibility for our actions, exactly, so don't do anything. Non-self! But the thing is, if you really knew there was no one in there and you were in an arahat, then of course you will have no responsibility. That means you don't get reborn, you don't make any more karma once you're an arahat, once you know. But if you don't know that yet, then taking no responsibility is actually just playing, it's not the real thing. And you will get karma back. So just think, oh, there's no self, it doesn't really matter. I can do whatever I like, you will get into big trouble. That's the problem. Some people, they just think they know non-self, but they don't. They're acting from a sense of self, which is why they get into trouble. So don't just try and play this and think, oh, there's no self. It's not an intellectual game. This is something which you see, and it just makes you turn around completely. It's one of the problems when people think too much, and especially as intellectuals, we think we can beat the system just by intellectualizing about it. It doesn't work that way. So you have to actually see non-self. And when there is non-self, no responsibility, irresponsibility, both don't make any difference. They don't apply anymore. But because you think there is a self, because you do think you own things, then you'll have to be responsible for your actions. If you really think you are totally enlightened and an arahat, if you really think that, if you really think you don't own anything, please sign over all your assets to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It's not yours anyway, so why not? Can you do that? No. Which means, yeah, you may think there's no self, but yeah, maybe there is. Dear Ajahn, what is staying unplanned? To get into this retreat, if one did not apply to come in, how could this have happened? Please explain briefly. You never applied to come here. You think you did it. You had no choice. You were conditioned to come here, so you didn't plan anyway. What you thought was a plan, what you assumed was you making all these decisions. No, it was not. Just like those people who get hypnotized. That story I tell about when I was a student at Cambridge, and there was always a hypnotist once a year would come to the Psychic Research Society, which I joined. I made many friends there. And, because I love ghosts, I had many friends who were ghosts and spirits, and witches. A witch would come every year. I remember the witch who would come every year. He had this brilliant name, Trevor Ravenscroft. What a brilliant name for a witch. And I remember he came up and gave his lecture. He said, I am a witch. And he said there are two types of witches, black witches and white witches. Black witches are incredibly dangerous, really dangerous. And if you see or hear one, get out quickly. Don't worry, I'm a white witch, he said. But even black witches say they're white witches. He just made us laugh. He's a good lecturer. But with the hypnotist, They're hypnotists. He made people do all sorts of stupid things. First of all, you know, you'd have to volunteer. So I went up to volunteer. I was not a good hypnotic subject. But there was always one or two who were really easy to hypnotize. And these were students, you know, we were 19, 18, 20, 21. They're having a good time. It's a nice evening out for a bit of fun and games. And I remember this one young student. I didn't know him, but, you know, he came along. He volunteered. He was hypnotized really deeply. And they made him do all sorts of stupid things. But then, the most important thing was they gave him this suggestion. He said, later on, when I touch my right earlobe, doesn't matter what anyone is doing, you're going to stand up and sing the British national anthem in a loud voice from beginning to end, without stopping. And okay, so then he did a few other tricks with this guy, and then took him out of hypnosis. Now, of course, all the audience, like me, I knew, you know, that this was going to happen. This poor fellow didn't. He was sitting down listening to whatever was going on. And the hypnotist would always come very close. He's a great entertainer. Come very close, and then he'd, you know, scratch his nose instead of touching his ear. So, you know, always we're waiting. What's going to happen when he touches his ear? And finally he did touch his ear. And this young man stood up and sang God Save Our, right from the beginning to the end, in a loud voice. And you can imagine a group of maybe 150 students. We were laughing and screaming and pointing at this fool for singing the national anthem. It was one of the most funniest things. And even though everybody was laughing at him, he continued to the end. He never stopped at all. Normally, if you start and people start laughing, you shut up straight away, embarrassed and red-faced. Not him. He carried on to the end, which was one amazing thing. And then the hypnotist, when everyone calmed down, he said, what did you do that for? And this guy gave a good reason, a logical reason, why he decided to sing the British national anthem then. And that sent shivers down my spine and many other people's spines, because it was very clear that he thought, and he was of the clear opinion, that he freely chose to do something which was absolutely ridiculous. Now that's something ridiculous. How about joining this retreat? Did you decide to come on this retreat? And this is not a ridiculous thing. I'll let you think about that. Who decided to come on this retreat? Now that really gets you into Dharma and non-self. Who makes all the decisions in your life? Dear Ajahn, if the process stopped and the flame extinguished, what is left? Exactly. This was something which the Buddha described. He used the simile of the flame. This is in the Aggi-Vajra-Gotra Sutta, perfect description of Nibbana. He said a flame. He used an oil flame, but you might as well use a candle flame. A candle flame depends upon three causes: the wax, the wick, and the heat. When those three causes come together, the wax, the wick, and the heat, you get a flame. If one of those causes is extinguished, you run out of wax, the wick gets all burnt out, or somebody blows the heat away, then the flame is extinguished. And when it's extinguished, where does it go? If it was a good flame, does it go to the heaven where all good flames live happily ever after? If it was a bad flame, does it go down to hell? Is there a place where the ground of all flames, where all the flames, their essence, can live happily ever after? What happens to a flame when it goes out? Where does it go? It's a stupid question, isn't it? It doesn't go anywhere. It's just stopped. It wasn't really there anyway. It's not something in the essence of a flame. It's just heat, wax, and wick. That's all it is, coming together. One of them disappears, then the flame disappears. And that was a Buddha simile for enlightenment. your five khandhas coming together, body, a feeling, perception, mental formations, including will and consciousness. When those consciousnesses, sorry, when those come together, you've got this thing we call me. And when one of those things disappears, you've gone out. That's all. Why do you think we have to go somewhere? Dear teacher, are monks not allowed to touch any other human beings? We might catch something. What speaks against a nice and warm hug among friends? Germs, that's what says against the bugs. By the way, where is the teddy bear? Yeah, where's the teddy bear gone? Is it run away? Because all teddy bears, maybe, I think I know the answer, the teddy bear, after all this meditation, has finally become enlightened, has been extinguished, and hasn't gone anywhere. There was no teddy bear to begin with. And now it has vanished, it's parinibbana, it's disappeared. Just like the flame. So the teddy bear now enlightened, see, it just goes. So why don't monks hug? Right. One of the reasons, if we hug a woman, then people say, you guys are celibate. Is there somebody, do you like that girl or something? You get done for sexual harassment. If you hug the kid, a nice boy, you'd be thinking, oh, another paedophile monk. If I hug the boy, a big boy, they'd think, oh, Ajahn Brahm's gay. So it's best not to do any hugging. Because you know, if you're a monk celibate, you know, you have got no partner, you've not got a family, you've got to be really careful because people think, my goodness, this is really weird. So it's because we're monastics, we just got to, you know, really act like monastics, and anything like that, any sort of physical contact, it's amazing what people will think. My father's favorite joke, and this is before I even thought of becoming a monk, and he said, this is, you know, when I was about 12 or 13, he kept on saying, what fun does a monk have? The answer is none. Right? Okay, you're really slow, you guys. So none could be N-O-N-E. They don't have any sex, or N-U-N, you know. But, you know, we don't do that. But because it's a joke, and people think, oh, yeah, you know, what the monks do. You know, when this place was being built, we had the builders over here. These were ordinary Aussie builders. And we were talking to them. Actually, somebody overheard them, you know, in their little canteen, which they had over here, talking about what the monks did. So on the weekend, they invite prostitutes in from town. And that's what they were saying over there. People listen. Because they don't know what monks are. And for many people, they think you have to have sex. You know, so you know, you're going to have it somewhere or other if you're a monk. Now, this is the sort of thing people think. So, you know, you have to actually be squeaky clean. You have to be seen to be pure. So otherwise, people have some really strange ideas of celibate monks and celibate nuns. That's why we have the celibate nuns. They're in one monastery. The monks are in another monastery. Now, just to make sure that the malicious people don't sort of just add one and one together and just make the wrong answer. They go, oh, just, well, you know, all the lay people go in the evening, just I wonder what the monks and nuns get up to. Do they have a party? You know, they get the guitars out and start messing around, and what happens? So we have to be really, really clear that we are celibate. That's why we don't do hugs. How can we train mind to be mindful all the time? You don't have to be mindful all the time. Just be mindful now. I think I made that point well. Dear Ajahn Brahm, with respect, I do believe you've opened a can of worms, having attended a retreat before I did. Adhere to the no comms, electronics, reading material rules, and although confronting, was worth enjoying and investigating. Okay. As you've granted use of the items both at the retreat and in the meditation hall, there are clicking of pages, beeping of phones, and glowing lights. Maybe this is what we need to cope with, but I'd rather not, making learning to meditate harder. Could the question not be why a person can't cope 9 days without distractions? Okay, so, you know, it's okay to have the iPod if you are sort of doing a guided meditation for yourself. Fair enough. But don't go answering emails in this room. Don't go clicking this and clicking that. So try and be kind to other people. If you want to sort of check those things, in your room maybe, or somewhere else, but not in the meditation hall. Because if your little gizmo goes beep when someone is just about to enter jhana, and your beep stops them, imagine the bad karma for that. That's really, really bad karma. And the karmic result of a gizmo going off when someone's about to get jhana is in its next life, your iPod or whatever it is will get reincarnated as a police speed camera. The lowest form of life for any electronic equipment. That and the parking meter, they're both pretty close together. So please, out of kindness, you know, don't go beeping all over the place. How does one direct their mind to the destruction of the asavas post-jhana? I will be giving a talk about that later. But you don't direct the mind directs you. It's automatic, so don't think, oh, what should I do? That should not be a question any time during this retreat. It's what am I doing, not what should I do. What am I doing? And you will find, whether you like it or not, you will look back at those great experiences called jhanas. And the one bit of brainwashing or hypnosis I'm going to give you, which I've given to many people, if you come out of jhanas, don't just look back and think what was happening there. Don't just look for the jhana factors. Don't just try and think of what was happening. Look for what was missing. This is two different ways of looking. You look at what's there, and you look at what's not there. And you will find you get the great wisdoms of enlightenment when you see what's not there. That is the interesting stuff. That is why, if you look at the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th stages of Anapanasati, now Anicca is one of the things you contemplate after you do jhanas. And what does Anicca mean? It does not mean impermanence or rise and fall. It's much more powerful than that. Anicca is the opposite of the word Nietzsche. Nietzsche means regular, something which is reliable, always there, keeps on coming up. Like the sunrise is Nietzsche. You can bank on it's going to happen later on. Ajahn Brahm telling bad jokes is Nietzsche. You can depend upon that. It's going to happen. But Anicca is when something which has always been dependable, always there, suddenly vanishes. Just like, now I mentioned in the Zen retreat, the wall vanished. That was Anicca experience. Look at the lake. See the waves on the surface? That's not Anicca. When the lake vanishes, that's Anicca. Something is missing. Now those are the things which are important. Now I've mentioned it, you will do it, whether you like it or not. That's enough to condition you, after jhanas, to see what was missing. And I will mention more about the importance of that later on. In the suttas, when the Buddha passed away into final nibbana, they said he went through each of the jhanas in succession. How did they know this? How do you know that somebody is in the jhanas? Ajahn Chah, he had a stroke, and he could not speak for years. And the monks, if you don't know this story, they had a big meeting and they said, okay, now he's done his service, he's taught plenty of stuff for us to go on. we'll just let nature take its course and let him die. So they made a decision. Everyone voted in favour of that. I was in Perth at the time. And as soon as the king of Thailand heard that, he said, no way, keep him alive. And for those of you who know in Thailand at that time, if the king of Thailand says something, you've got to do it. So against the monk's wishes, they had to keep Ajahn Chah alive at all costs. So the king of Thailand, he paid for a male nurse in rotation to look after him, 8-hour shifts, you know, for every hour of the day. And had a couple of monks were also in attendance, you know, on a roster basis. And one of the monks told me that one night Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And the male nurse got very upset and very panicky. He stopped breathing. And we all knew that Ajahn Chah would die one day, so did the nurse. But he didn't want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift, quite naturally. So he wanted to try and resuscitate Ajahn Chah. And the monk said, leave him alone, he's just in jhana, because that's a sign of a fourth jhana that you stop breathing. And the male nurse just was not at ease with this at all, so they came to a compromise. A very interesting little experiment was done. The male nurse insisted on taking blood samples every few minutes, thinking that as long as the blood is oxygenated, then there'll be no brain damage. So he took blood samples every few minutes for about 3 or 4 hours while Ajahn Chah was in his jhana state, and he noticed that the oxygen level in the blood was constant, even though he was not breathing. Even though the heart was beating, but very, very low. Don't know where the oxygen was coming from, but it was oxygenated all the time, without any breath, without any breathing. So that's how you can know that this is how the monks knew that, okay, Ajahn Chah, maybe he couldn't speak, but he still could do the jhanas when he was in this coma thing. So that's how some of the monks know. Maybe they did take blood samples, but they could see he wasn't breathing, but still alive. And if you want to know the difference, because sometimes at the end of this retreat, who knows, maybe Venerable Gotami may be sitting there perfectly still. She doesn't hear the sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. If you don't hear those three big sadhus, you must be in a deep meditation. And what should we do with her? Should we send her to the morgue? Or is she in jhana? How can we know? You know the difference, how you can know. If she's in jhana, the body is still warm. If she's dead, she's cold. That's actually what they say in the suttas. Amazing, but I didn't mention that fellow the other day who was in the jhanas in the hospital. That was another reason why the doctor gave him the defibrillators. I didn't mention that because his body was still warm. That was weird. He should be cold if he'd been dead for such a long time. So that's the other thing. So before you send Venerable Gotami to the morgue, please see if she's warm. If she's cold, then off she goes. That's how you can know. Ajahn, I felt very angry today. Very good. Now, I say very good a lot. Even in your interviews, you may have noticed, those of you who have gone in there, you say, I've been really sleepy. I say, very good. My meditation's not very good today. I say, very good. Now, I'm so well known for that, that all the monks, they say, Ajahn Brahm, you take a rest today. I'll do the interviews for you. Because I know how to do interviews. People say whatever, and you always say, very good. But I do that on purpose, so you don't reject anything from this retreat. You don't think, oh, this is a waste of a day, I got angry today. You don't judge with negativity, you don't have fault finding. I say very good to everything on purpose. So you feel angry today, very good. Be kind to it, accept it, it's part of life to be angry. habitual pattern of thinking and a bit of a victim mentality that's also become a habit. Just like in your talk today, I tried what you said with the thought, but they caught me and left me feeling very upset. Since this, I tried to sit in silence in a moment, which has helped. A terrible thought came just after meditation where the breath caught me. So after a nice meditation, that's it. So after a nice meditation, I had a nice meditation in the end. Well done. Anger, it passes. You can't be angry that long. See if you can beat your record. That was Ajahn Chah's method. He said if you get very angry about something or other, go to your room, put a clock in front of you, and see if you can beat your record for being angry. See how many minutes you can be angry for. That was his method. And there's a really good reason for that, because once you see a clock in front of you, then you are objectifying the anger. It's not so personal anymore. It's not me being angry. It's just this anger, like I said today in the movies. Put space between you and that emotion. Here's me. I'm not angry, just the mind is angry. It's over there somewhere. Me, I'm just sitting here watching anger. But you don't get involved and entangled in it. Because if you get entangled, it says, I shouldn't be angry. I don't want to be angry. Then you're getting angry at being angry. And you know what happens? We're such complicated human beings. Then we get angry at being angry at being angry. I shouldn't be angry. But I shouldn't be angry. Oh God, it gets really complicated. So just be angry. And just let it go. And then it does not last. So, whoever wrote this, very good. As long as you don't become a psychopath and go around with a chainsaw, you can be angry, but as long as you don't do anything about it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if I develop psychic powers through meditation and use it to win a lottery ticket, would it be cheating, stealing, breaking the five precepts? As long as you give me 10% for the monastery, then I'll absolve you of all the sin. How can someone get another person to keep precepts, especially the last precept of the five? Or is it useless trying to explain to them until they realize themselves? It's easy. Just change. If it's at home, just pour all the alcohol out and change it to, say, apple juice. Because apple juice looks like whiskey. Does it? And so put apple juice in there. And they say, this apple juice, this whiskey, what's gone wrong with it? He said, because I've just been on a retreat, and I've learned the trick to turn a wine into water. Because that's what Jesus did. He did it the other way around. He turned, water into wine? We do it the other way around, wine into water. We taught, your whiskey is now apple juice. Your red wine is now blackcurrant juice. Or whatever. So can you do that? At least at home. If that doesn't work, if you are an Asian, then you can try this trick, which really does work. Because many Asians are terrified of ghosts. And you will tell them that the worst ghost in the whole world is called the bottle ghost. The bottle ghost. Now, I've seen it myself, honestly, no joke. I've seen the bottle ghost possess people. And they speak in a strange voice. It's not themselves anymore. The character is totally changed. When people get possessed by a ghost. And I've seen it kill people, even here in Australia as well. It's the most dangerous ghost in the world, the bottle ghost. It lives in bottles of whiskey and vodka and beer. You open the top and you drink it. It possesses you. You speak in a very strange, and you can't even walk in a straight line. If you drive a car, it kills you. That's why whiskey, vodka is called spirits. So that, be careful. And that does possess people. You see people die because of that. So you should be afraid of the bottle ghost. So that's one way of getting people to take the five pieces. If that doesn't work, I remember this guy, he came. Now, I was only a young monk, 3 or 4 years as a monk, and this whole busload of Thais, they came to a monastery in Ubon province. And one of them came out, and they were doing this monastery hopping trips. Now, in Australia, they call it pub crawls, but there they don't do pub crawls in Thailand. They do monastery crawls. They go and visit this monastery, and then they get in the bus and go to another monastery for the weekend. But anyway, this guy, you know, took a few bottles of Singha beer in the bus with him. By the time he came to our monastery, he was drunk. He really was drunk. And when you're drunk, you know, you lose all sense of self-respect and what's appropriate. He was shouting away, and the other people on the bus were very embarrassed about him. And they asked me, they said, "Can't you tell him something not to drink?" And he said, "Yeah, can the Western monk stop, tell me something to stop me drinking?" He put the challenge. I said, "Okay, sit down." And I told him, "Dogs don't drink alcohol. You drink alcohol. Who's higher, a dog or you?" And this man said, "Sadhu, sadhu, I've been taught by the Western monk. Oh, it's so deep. I'm so embarrassed." And everyone else was laughing their heads off, because calling someone a dog, you know, in Asia is a very, very rude thing to say. But, you know, he was a dog. I mean, dogs don't drink alcohol. He did. So who's higher? So you can tell your husband or wife, whoever's drinking the alcohol, especially if you're Asian. Okay, now, are you a human being? Are you lower than a dog? Drinking alcohol. It's tough. But sometimes it works. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahmawangsa, don't think that we don't know what you are doing. Uh-oh. I've been busted. Instead of meditating in your cave and get jhanas and enlightenment, you sacrifice that for others, teaching others to reach jhana. That is rare human quality. Only a superhuman does that. We appreciate that. I hope you do that in the last months of your life. Thank you. I spend a lot of time in my cave. But the best cave is not the cave over the road. It's what the Buddha called the cave of the heart. And sometimes, this is not a joke thing. Am I really sacrificing by teaching all you guys? I thought in my early years as being a monk, I was sacrificing by doing the other monks' visas. I still have plenty of time to meditate, but not as much as other monks did. And when we all came together and we talked, my meditation was much better than theirs. And I couldn't believe it. Why, when you've had more time than me, and my meditation is deeper? And I realized that if you just do it for yourself, that selfishness, that desire, that inability to let go makes your meditation very dry. When you do service for others, when you're kind to others, when in your room you don't get upset when someone turns on the kettle at 3 o'clock in the morning to make themselves a cup of tea, because that's selfish if you think, why are they doing that? They're spoiling my meditation. If instead you think these beautiful thoughts, oh, isn't it wonderful? They're really getting up early. Having a cup of tea so they can meditate. That gives me so much joy that people are really getting into this retreat. If you think like that, then you have this lack of fault finding, this beautiful, compassionate, serving, kind mind. You have great meditation. Because I was developing kindness, selflessness, letting go of what I want, that was powering my meditation. So the whole, even in this retreat, don't ever think that when you're chopping up the vegetables for lunch, you are just wasting time. Chopping up vegetables for lunch, if you do it really with a lot of love and care and service, thinking that you are giving all these meditators the opportunity to have a good meal, then you have great meditation in the afternoon. Balance the service with the solitude. If you balance it just right, you get the very, very best. Too much solitude, you get very dry. The mind gets hard and it just cannot get it into the deep meditations. Too much service, you just get worn out. Just find a balance, and your mind is just beautiful. So you can meditate very deeply, because your mind is soft. Balance the service, you know, with the time by yourself. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for your enlightening teaching. That means you must be enlightened, if my teaching is enlightening. As you know, when we are in present moment aware, we are much more conscious to the sensual beauty around us. Can being with the senses lead to enlightenment, or must one always get past them to the mind? Or are they delusions of senses? Thank you for your advice. P.S. I feel like I must look like a grinning fool. I'm enjoying meditating so much. No, you're allowed to grin. The more you grin, the better. So, when you actually get peaceful mind, again, everything does look beautiful, but it's a beauty which doesn't really lead to you getting too attached. You see the beauty of the floor, you see the beauty of the bricks, you see the beauty of the sunset. But you know the sunset is going to pass. You never cry at the end of the sunset, oh, the sun gone down, it went down too quick, what am I going to do now? The beauty of natural phenomena is something which you don't tend to want to possess. Now, if it's people, you see a beautiful girl or a hunky boy, then sometimes you do want to possess them. Or if you see like a muffin, which, oh, that looks nice, then you want to possess it. But if it's like, you know, birds singing, there's no sense of wanting to own that. It's enjoying it and letting it go. Which is why many of the beauties of nature are almost like allowable, permissible to have fun with. Because you cannot capture them. And you know that. So happiness is which cannot be owned, which cannot be captured, you can enjoy. Such as, you know, the beauties of nature. So when that happens, because you're getting a very still and peaceful mind, you can go for it, it's not dangerous. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is anapanasati samatha or vipassana? It is sampasana or vimatta. Both together. Okay, here we go, the samatha vipassana story. There were this couple, girl and boy, living together, never got married, but they lived together in a very loving, caring partnership. He was called Sam Atta. She was called Vipassana. And Sam and Vi, after lunch one day, they decided to go for a walk up Samadhi Mountain. And when they went up to Samadhi Mountain, of course, they took their dog with them, who was called Metta. So Sam, Atta, Vipassana, and Metta the dog went on a walk up Meditation Mountain. Sam, he went up that mountain because it was so peaceful up there, so quiet up there. Vi, she took her camera with her because she went up there for the view. Had amazing insights at the top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog, what does a dog go on a walk for? Just for fun. Metta went up there for piti sukha. When they got halfway up the mountain, oh, it was so still halfway up Meditation Mountain, that Sam was so satisfied how peaceful it was. But he also had a pair of eyes, so he could enjoy the view too. Vi, she was taking shots with her camera, you know, insight shots to keep for later on. But she could also appreciate the silence, even halfway up. And Metta the dog, weird, but the more it climbed up Meditation Mountain, the more Metta the dog wagged her tail. More happiness, the higher she got. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, oh, it was so peaceful up there, so still. Sam was absolutely content. But he could also see the incredible view. On the top of that mountain, you could see everything. Every Dhamma you could see. Anatta, Dukkha, Anatta, Sunyata. You could see everything from on top of Meditation Mountain. So he enjoyed that too. Vipassana, wow, she was taking all these amazing photographs. Incredible things. But she could also appreciate the peace up there. Really peaceful. Met the dog. She could experience the peace. She could also see the view. And she was also experiencing the incredible bliss up there. You know what happens to a dog when they get really excited? They go, wagging their tail like it might come off, running around in circles, just ecstatic, met the dog. And the meaning of that simile is, on top of Meditation Mountain, peace, the view, and the joy, the bliss, the metta, coexist. So wherever you practice samatha, vipassana and metta, they go along. Sam never goes without his wife and his dog. Vi never goes without her husband and the dog. And the dog always brings the other two along. I don't care whether you're doing samatha, vipassana or metta, they all go together. You cannot split them up. So is anapana, samatha or vipassana? It is both. And it's also metta as well. Why do you face different problems and get different experiences every day? Is this normal? No, it's really abnormal. Whoever wrote that is really a bad case. I need to go and see a psychiatrist pretty quickly. Otherwise, no, it's perfectly normal. You face different problems and get different experiences every day. Just like you get different food every day. You get different stories from me. Well, maybe not every day, but... you always get a new one every now and again. It is called just the changing nature of everything. So even every breath, if you're very aware, every breath is different, let alone other things you have to face in life. So because it's always different, what you learned before, you cannot apply to the next problem. You cannot just decide, oh, now I know how to do things. Instead, you have this beautiful open mind, which can see every problem in its unique way, and find the unique solution. Don't be a prisoner of the past. It worked before, therefore it must work now. No. See the problem now. Find the unique solution, and then you're in life again. Dear Ajahn, my first teachings and meditation lessons came from the Mahayana. That's my teaching. I didn't say Mahayana, I've used Meditation. My teachings is not Theravada. It is not Hinayana. It's not Vajrayana. It's not Mahayana. What is my tradition? Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-yana. The Mahayana. Taking the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, the Yana from Vajrayana, to combine everything together to Mahayana. Because you know sometimes that some of the traditions are just so dry. No one ever laughs. And just, what do you want to sort of be in a tradition like that for? You know, it's supposed to be the end of suffering, not more suffering. You know, you have enough suffering when you go to work. You want to have more suffering when you come on. This is your holiday. Now, sometimes you have to beg from your boss to get time to come here. If not from your boss, I mean that's your wife or your husband, to beg from them, please, boss, please, please, please. And finally come here. If you don't have a good time, it means you're not doing good things. I always tell people, if you want a good time, be a good person. Do good things. Do good meditation. That's called being a good time meditator. I'm a good time monk. I have a good time. Because I'm a good person. I keep my precepts. I meditate. I let go. That's why you're happy. So, it doesn't really matter what traditions. But as far as I remember, I didn't hear something about jhanas or nimitta. Did I miss it, or didn't they have these different stages? Actually, they all have those stages. But actually, I taught this over in Melbourne last Monday, Tuesday, a week ago. In Vietnam tradition, I was told, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, all the senior monks in Vietnam, because they have Mahayana and Theravada there, they had a meeting and they decided not to teach jhanas to lay people. And the reason was they thought it was just too troublesome because the lay people, they won't be able to get jhanas, and so why teach them? It's just too much trouble for the monks and the nuns there. And I was disgusted when I heard that. And the same thing as even when I started teaching jhanas, some of the monks said, "Oh, you're wasting your time. They're only lay people. They will never be able to achieve jhanas." And maybe because I came from an egalitarian tradition, you know, in the West, I thought, that's really gross. You know, you're demeaning, looking down upon the lay community. And you know, if in the time of the Buddha, lay people got jhanas, that's what I read. And so I thought, well, why not teach them now? You teach them and you do get jhanas. So those monks were wrong. So it may be that you don't hear it because that tradition is still current. Maybe in some places they think, you know, you guys can't teach, do jhanas. Just, you know, give donations to the monks, do your chanting, keep your precepts, and that's it. That's really demeaning. Buddhism is not going to survive if you teach, monks and nuns teach like this. So, you know, there's a few of us, we started, okay, let's go and teach the monk, teach the lay people jhanas. And they do it. So we proved it works. So that might be right, why the reason why. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please explain why you do chanting for a dead person? Yes. What we do is, you know, you've heard my chanting, it's not the very best. You know, I'm not Justin Bieber, I'm not, who's that other guy? The fat guy who sings all his operas. Pavarotti. Yeah, I'm not Pavarotti. I've got the same tummy as Pavarotti, but not the same voice. But my chanting is so bad, by many, and that is why monks like me are always invited to do Ghostbusters. Because when they hear my chanting is so bad, no self-respecting ghost can stand it. They run away screaming, "Ah, not more of that terrible chanting, ah!" So that's why the bad chanting of Theravada monks is the most sought after to get rid of ghosts. Ghosts hate it. No, why do we chant for a dead person? A lot of times it's actually not for the dead person. We chant for the people who are left behind because it makes them feel good. Basically, it's just to satisfy the grief of the people who are left behind, the grandmas and whatever, because especially Asians are so superstitious. If we don't do it exactly the right way, you know, you get afraid or you get really upset. So quite a few times you've asked people, look, we don't need to do that chanting. Let's do something a bit more appropriate. But then the children come and say, no, please, Ajahn Brahm, do the chanting, otherwise my grandma, my mother or something will be really upset. So a lot of times the chanting is to make the relations, especially the elderly ones, feel a little bit better. That's the main reason. So hopefully in the future we can teach Buddhists not to be so superstitious. So you don't need to do so much chanting anymore. You don't need to waste so much money on funerals. The trouble is that, you know, you can't get a simple casket because you think, if I get a simple casket from my grandma, all my friends will think I don't really care for her and love her. So I've got to get the very best for grandma, and you get these really, really expensive coffins, and you'll end up like what happened to me when I did a funeral service for a Chinese man who died. The families, Chinese are really into just expensive funerals and big coffins. The coffin was so huge with all the ornaments on it that when they lowered it into the grave, it happened, real true story, it got stuck halfway. So there was their father halfway down the grave and they couldn't pull it out and they couldn't push it down. And I was doing this chanting. I had to keep on doing this chanting. Round and round and round and round and round again. I got a sore throat by the end of this because they couldn't actually lower it. Soon later they yanked it and they managed to free it, for goodness sake. But you know, that's what happened. If you have too big a coffin, you can't lower it down, for goodness sake. I always great sort of funeral stories. Another great funeral, which I did, I don't know if you know this, but this is law in all the states of Australia. You can build your own coffin if you wish. You have a certain size limit, but you can do it yourself. You don't have to buy it. So I learned that, and so I actually told, I shouldn't have done this, I shouldn't have actually told you, because you get the same problem. I told this to this guy who died. He was a white water rafter. That was his business. That was his what he loved doing. He died of cancer, very young. So his father decided to, you know, to do something which was represented him. He was a bit of a carpenter, so he made this coffin in the shape of a boat, and he put two oars on top of it. Fine, it was the right size. The problem was he made it out of this really thick jarrah. It weighed a ton. So it was okay, they managed to get it out of the hearse, you know, a dozen of them, lifting it on to the little conveyor belt. This was in Fremantle in the open committal area. They put it on the conveyor belt, fine. And then when we got to that point, you press the button and the sort of a little partition opens up and it goes behind and then partition closes again. It's committed. For this guy, the conveyor belt was struggling and struggling actually to pull it through. The must have been a different motor on the little door which opened up, because the door closed again when the coffin was only halfway through. And once again it was stuck halfway in and halfway out. Now what I always remember is that when these things happen, the look on the funeral director's face. Now their worst fears, because they've paid a lot of money to make sure the funeral actually happens perfectly. And they were just mortified. I thought they were going to be the next one in the coffin. And the wife, you know, she comes over to Bodhinyar, to Dhammaloka, Jenny. She always sits, you know, pretty much in front of me. Jenny, the wife, the grieving wife, she jumped up on the coffin and tried to push the door aside. And everyone else started saying, "You're really trying to get rid of him quickly, aren't you?" And the whole thing descended into a farce. And that was one of the best funerals I've ever been to. Everyone was laughing, and even the funeral director was just giggling away. And that was one of those funerals I will never forget, when things went wrong. So when things go right in ceremonies, they're really dull. So when things go wrong, they're human. And, you know, one of his best friends who grew up with him, he shouted out, "Yeah, that's typical of Steve. The first day he bought a car, he crashed that. The first day in his coffin, he crashes his coffin." So that's, why do we chant it for dead persons? So it's just for the people around. How can a dead person receive your blessing? They are not alive, indeed. What happened to the couple on wedding day when you gave the wrong chanting, the chanting of a dead person on the wedding day? Oh, they're still together. So that was very good. Knowing that those dearest to us can cause us pain and sorrow when they depart, how should we behave now to prepare ourselves? Yeah, you can imagine that they're going to die today. Maybe they are dead. Maybe they're back home and they're gone. How do you feel? Remember the simile I gave when my father died of the concert. Very lovely simile, because I never felt sad when my father died. And I couldn't understand exactly how I felt, because I was only 16 and a boy. But it's a great, when you're a monk and you become aware, you become mindful, you get to know your emotions. You know, it's weird for a man to do that, but when you meditate, you really get to understand the emotional world. And I could see that the emotion I felt when my father died was exactly the same as the emotion I felt after a great concert. The concert was over. I would never hear that again. But I never felt sad. I never cried after a great concert. I felt so privileged. What a wonderful thing it was to have known a man like that for 16 years. What a wonderful thing it was to go to these great musical performances in London. That's how I felt. And I teach people that. Why not look at a person's life like the end of a great concert? Brilliant, wonderful. How lucky I was to have been there. Then you don't have to grieve anymore. So you're part of a concert now. Yeah, it's going to end. Maybe your dad is on his deathbed and you shout for more. Come on, Dad. And they give you another few days, but then they pass away. Well done. What a great life that was. Can you please explain how to get rid of inner chatting? I've already mentioned about the Namo Buddhaya. If that doesn't work, try lobotomy. You heard the story about the guy who woke up in hospital after an operation? He had a splitting headache and he complained of a swelling on his head. And the nurse said, "Oh, you can't have it, it was just a simple sort of operation on your appendix. We never had nothing to do with your head." He said, "Look, it's hurting, I'll give me something for the headache and for the swelling." And she felt his head, and it was really hot, and there was a bump on his head. So he went to the surgeon who'd just done the operation. There must be some complication. The patient is complaining about a splitting headache and a bump on his head. The surgeon said, "Oh yeah, that's to be expected, because we ran out of anaesthetic halfway through the operation." The doctor in the back there laughing. Well, you know, doctors have to, you know, hospitals have to cut costs. They can't. Kidding yourself, laughing. Okay, anyway, what was the question anyway? I can explain about how to get rid of inner chatting. It's why do you chat so much? Put spaces between the words. Try, if that doesn't work, go out into nature, take your shoes off, feel the sensations in your body, listen to the birds, feel the cold of the aircon and the heat of the sun midday, whatever it is, because when you're actually feeling and hearing the sounds of birds, you can't be chatting at the same time. Afterwards you can chat, that was cold, that was hot, that was a pigeon or whatever. But when you're actually listening, you have to listen in silence. Otherwise you miss it. So when you get into feeling and hearing, you know, the sounds and the experiences of nature, that is a very good way to stop the chatting. It will come back again when you start meditating, but at least you get some breaks, you get to know what it's like not to chat, to have the silence. And when you know what it's like to have the silence, it grows on you. And it becomes much easier to be quiet. You mentioned one cannot attain jhana through vipassana. I thought jhana can be attained using any kind of meditation. Samatha, vipassana, metta and anapanasati. What is the purpose of vipassana then? Thank you with metta. I never said that. You are defaming me. I'm going to see my lawyer. I am going to sue you for... Now, I say so many things. I say so much that sooner or later you can find I said everything about everything because I speak too much. But, yes, you can achieve jhana through vipassana. And people do. They do whatever they call vipassana is, just body contemplation, and sometimes they get so peaceful that off they go, they get into a jhana. So, because there's no difference. Where there's vipassana, samatha comes behind. And metta as well. They all go together. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Mr. Teddy Bear, can we have it there till the end of the retreat? I told you, the teddy bear has disappeared. He's vanished into the great void. He has disappeared into Nibbana, into the ground of all teddy bears, into the original teddy bear essence. But who knows, maybe if your wishes are fulfilled, a teddy bear might manifest tomorrow morning. Maybe. And if you don't believe in reincarnation, when teddy bear gets reincarnated tomorrow, you will know it's true. Dear Ajahn, what dates are the Upasa day in each month and what observances should we hold? They are the moon days, which is the full moon, the new moon, you can see those easily, and in between. What observances should we uphold? You should uphold just being in the present moment, and then every day is your Upasana day. Every moment, the moon may be full or half full or whatever, but it's full somewhere. There's always a full moon if you actually go around to, you know, the other side of the earth or something, or, you know, go into space. What do you mean, today's a full moon and it's not a full moon the other day? Somewhere in Mars, it's always a full moon. Whatever. So it doesn't really matter. Any day is a good day to practice. Every day is an auspicious day. So you can observance uphold every day instead of just on your posture days.
How's the time going? Oh, I'm going well today.
Venerable teachers, can you please advise how to cultivate bodhicitta and which mistakes have to be avoided, e.g. nourishing our attachments, etc.? Nourishing your attachments. Please be attached to the right things. Sometimes people think you should let go of all attachments. Please, if you're riding on the back of a motorbike, please be attached. Do not let go. So, bodhicitta is just a mind thinking of enlightenment. Now, people think that that is a mind deciding, I will become a Buddha one day. It's not, it's just a mind understanding what enlightenment is, what freedom is, what no self is. It's not when you think of attaining anything, like a Buddhahood or whatever. All attainments go against the idea of Dhamma. You're not trying to be anybody. You're disappearing. You're vanishing. So, the idea to cultivate bodhicitta is just to cultivate a mind which can see enlightenment. And what is a mind which can see enlightenment, which has some bodhisukha, which can experience the happiness of enlightenment? That is jhana. Jhana mind. So if you want to cultivate bodhicitta, I say that is jhana mind. We have some bodhisukha. Dear Ajahn Brahm, long time back when I was meditating, I could see the bright nimitta, and through it I could go inside into a waterfall of lights flowing continuously on my face, where it's like going into a different world. I guess this is the first jhana, but I couldn't reach that stage again. Before the nimitta appeared, the background was so bright and full of lights, and in front of me the nimitta appeared like the full moon. Is this a sequence where the background should be bright and powerful before the nimitta appears, or even though the background is not very bright, is there a possibility that nimitta can appear? Please advise. Nimittas can appear in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of sequences. So, you know, just like every experience is different, you face different problems and get different experiences every day. You experience different nimittas every day. The whole point is not so much the nimitta, but where it's coming from. Coming from stillness, peace, kindness. So all your job is to cultivate a garden, is to make sure the soil is well watered and well fertilized. It's rich soil. And then you know great flowers will grow in that soil. So the soil is the mind, and the water is the awareness, the fertilizer is the kindness. Those things, if you make sure that they are generated, then the nimittas will come. But if you try and just want nimittas, I want nimittas, where's the nimittas, without getting the causes, of course you won't get anything. Like people want to be rich. And then, but they don't know that if you want to be rich, you've got to go to work and don't spend much. That's my, when people come and said, what's the secret of being wealthy? Work hard, spend little. And people don't like that. They want other ways. You know, can you please teach us psychic powers to see the lottery numbers? Can you teach us something to get rich? Can you get heavenly beings to help you get rich? It's a story which I wrote in my new book, if you haven't read it yet. But this guy was at home one afternoon, and he heard a sound. Go to the casino. And he thought he's imagining things, you know, just being alone. But then he heard it again. Go to the casino. He looked around, someone playing a joke on him. There's no one in the room. You know, the house was empty. Go to the casino, it said really loudly this time. He couldn't mistake it. So he thought, you know, maybe his old grandfather was looking after him or whatever. He thought, why not? So he went to the casino. And as he was walking in the casino, he heard the voice again. Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table. So he went to the roulette table. And as he sat down at the roulette table, he heard the voice say, put $10 on number 7. put $10 on number 7. Why not? Would you do that? So, you know, it's a supernatural advice. You put $10 on number 7. And the croupier, he sort of twirled the roulette wheel, threw the ball in, went round and round and round, and it fell on number 7. And he could hear the spirit, whatever it was, say, "Yeah! Yeah!" And when he got his winnings, he heard it say again, "Put all the money on number 12. Put all the money on number 12. So put all the money on number 12. Supernatural advice, why not? And the previous ran the wheel, threw the ball in, went round and round and round. It went on number 12. And he could hear the spirit say, "Woohoo! Woohoo! Yes! Put all the money on number 26. Put all the money on number 26. He heard it. No one else heard it. Just him. So he put all the money on number 26. The croupier spanned the wheel, threw the ball in, went round and round, and it fell on number 26. And then jumped out onto number 27. And he heard it very clearly. The spirit say, "Oh, shit." So even spirits swear when they make mistakes, because they make mistakes. Ajahn, in your talk this morning, it's an old joke, but it's a good one. In your talk this morning, you jokingly mentioned a depressed person getting a greyish nimitta. They weren't depressed, they were just, you know, a bit naughty. I think they were having an affair with somebody. So they got this big stain on their nimitta. So can a depressed person also be able to attain the jhana? Eventually a depressed person. There's no such thing as a depressed person. There's a person who's having an episode of depression. Just turn it around, for goodness sake. There's no such thing as a depressed person, okay? The old simile. I think I mentioned it. The two children in the supermarket checkout. One dropped a jar of honey, the other one dropped a jar of milk. The one who dropped the jar of honey, the mother said, "You stupid boy." The one who dropped the milk, "That was a stupid thing you did, son." There's a huge lot of difference there. If you say that's "you stupid boy," it's like, you know, the whole boy is stupid. And that's not fair. The other person was not Buddhist. "That's a stupid thing you did, son. You're not a stupid boy, but that's a stupid thing you did." And that is wise. So never ever say to your partner, "You're stupid, you're a liar." They're not a liar, they just told a lie, that's all. But that doesn't make them a liar. It's if they lie every time. Now you can understand why there's no such thing as a depressed person. There's people who have episodes of depression. Now I've told those sorts of stories such a long time. The classic example, and this was really moving for me, when I went to Singapore to do a session in the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore, in the north of the island, in the old Woodlands Hospital, but they moved it to a new campus. And this is supposed to be, you know, Singapore, a hub. They were trying to make money by getting really, really top-notch doctors using psychology, psychiatry, and getting many people from places like China to go over there, to fly into Singapore, get really good treatment, and fly back again, you know, the medical tourism business. And so they had really, really good professors. So when I gave my talk, one of the professors took me aside afterwards and said, "Now, that was a really good talk. I agree with everything you did. I'm a Christian," he said, "but can you please come and give a Buddhist blessing to my ward?" Because he was really impressed with what I said. So of course I did. And I said, "No, what do you do in your ward?" He said, "This is a schizophrenia unit." I said, "How do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore these days?" And that's when this great man said to me, I don't treat schizophrenia anymore in the schizophrenia ward. I don't treat it. Just like you said, Ajahn Brahm, in your talk. I treat the other part of the patient, which isn't schizophrenic. And that moved me so much. I put my hands up to him and said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." That's like worshipping someone. I said, "I worship just your wisdom there. Brilliant. Now you've got it."
And I did ask afterwards, what's the results? I knew what the answer was going to be. He said, much, much, much better than conventional treatment. They don't treat the schizophrenia, they treat the other part of the patient. Because sometimes if you're a depressed person, you think, I am depressed. You don't see the other part of yourself. If you say you're schizophrenic, they think, God, that's who I am. You're not a person, it's something else inside of you, something more than that. And if that's focused on and treated, that grows and it squashes the schizophrenia away. So are you a bad meditator? Are you hopeless? No, you've just had some hopeless meditations, that's all. That doesn't mean you're a hopeless meditator. If you understand that, you understand just a beautiful, wise piece of advice, that no one is a criminal. The guys who come here wearing green to do the watering or whatever, they're not criminals. They're people who've done criminal acts. They're not murderers. They're people who've murdered. They don't need to be afraid. They're beautiful people. So there we go. There's no such thing as a depressed person. There's people who go through episodes of depression. Simple. And that is the emptiness. That means I'm not depressed anymore. I'm finished. I can go to bed. Woohoo! Yes! Okay. So, those of you who've got energy, you can meditate some more. Those of you who haven't got energy, you can still meditate some more. Those of you who are tired, you can stay here. Those of you who've got energy, you can go to bed. Whatever happens. So please enjoy this evening. And there's always another day tomorrow to meditate, so have a good evening. And I will see you tomorrow, after we've done the three over-the-top, extreme, stupid but fun sadhus. Are you ready? Let's give it everything you've got. A different sadhu never given before. Sadhu. Very good.